listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. In as we go through our program today, I want to get into banking and what this all means. Randall Ray is going to be with us, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, about some of Alan Minsky's work. This should be fascinating. This will be in our third hour. Stephanie Miller is going to drop by the way. And interesting, the state of Texas, just their ban on gay marriage, on same-sex marriage, just got struck down by a federal judge as unconstitutional. And I want to get into, are we in a bubble? There's a fascinating story in today's Financial Times about Tesla's stock that I think indicates that, you know, we are heading for a crash, not necessarily next week, but Ha-Joon Chang has a fascinating piece about this. So he's been a guest on this program. We'll talk about that. Right now, however, Derek Green is on the line with us. He's a member of Project 21, currently pursuing his doctorate in the ministry, but he's with Project 21. That's nationalcenter.org/p21index.html. And Derek, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. The bill that would allow businesses to discriminate against gay people in the state of Arizona is now before Jan Brewer to be signed or vetoed. She's already vetoed a similar bill to this once. And you want to speak on behalf of this bill? Do I have that right?
Yes. Personally, I don't know where I stand on supporting the bill, but from what I've seen of the bill, I've read the bill, the merits of the bill, I don't see what the problem is. I should correct you that it's not an anti-gay bill. The bill itself doesn't mention gay, homosexuality, transgender, transsexuals, gay marriage or civil unions in the entire bill. All it does is it expands the freedom of religious liberty, and it has certain provisions in the bill that would prevent the free exercise of religious liberty to be infringed upon by the state. So that being said, you know, I think I am in support of this bill the way the bill is worded right now.
So this bill gives businesses the right to discriminate based on their religion. So let me understand this. I'm working in a hardware store, and you walk in, and let's say I'm a member of one of the Mormon branches that broke off before 1987 when the Mormon Church decided to change their official position on black people. The black people had the mark of Cain on them, and therefore they were, you know, not entitled to ever get into heaven and couldn't become members of the Mormon Church. And you being an African American, you walk into my store, and I look at you, and I say, and you say, hey, I came in to buy a screwdriver. Do you have a Phillips head? And I said, I'm sorry, my religion says that I'm not going to serve you, so I'm not going to sell you that screwdriver. You're okay with that?
No, I'm not okay with that. But again, the law isn't set up to discriminate religiously. Now keep in mind, there are certain provisions in the bill that have to be cleared before a person can use this bill to sue to say that the state is infringing upon them. Now, I wouldn't be okay with that because I think that that's a racial discrimination. Versus
okay, and race is protected by law in both in the state of Arizona and federally. So let's say I'm working in the hardware store and you come in and I look at you and I say, you know, that pink shirt you've got on makes me wonder if you're a homosexual. Are you gay? Because if you are, I'm not going to sell you that screwdriver. You're okay with that?
No, I'm not. But again, now remember, first and foremost, gays aren't a protected class in Arizona. Second of all, if there was discrimination simply based on a person being gay, we would hear instances upon instances of it, considering how much attention that Arizona's getting in states like Kansas, for example, aren't getting. So no, I'm not okay with that. I think that to discriminate against those people from a legal perspective.
But you're okay with a law that says that that's okay.
No, I'm okay with a law that gives a person the flexibility to serve gay patrons, but to rescind their services based on, let's say, if it's going to infringe upon their religious beliefs.
So right. So how does that play out? You're the clerk in the store now, and I walk in, and you're trying to decide whether or not to serve me because your religion says that you can't engage in commerce. In fact, you don't even want them in this. You don't even want gay people in your store. What are you going to ask me to determine if I'm gay?
Well, that's a projection. No storekeeper is saying we don't want gays in our store.
Oh, sure they are.
Not in Arizona. Because again, we would see, again, because of the considerable amount of tension that this Arizona law is getting, we would hear these instances. Now, again, the gays aren't a protected class in Arizona, so if there was overt and a high level of discrimination against gays, we would have heard it. Now, if I was...
You don't think gays are discriminated against right now in Arizona?
No. I didn't say that they weren't being discriminated against. What I'm saying is a wholesale discrimination against gays because they're gay. But let me finish this thought. It's not about discrimination against gays. Again, the law doesn't discriminate against gays, and it doesn't allow for the discrimination against gays. What it does is allow people to not provide services for issues or behaviors that are going to infringe upon their religious beliefs.
Right.
So just as these people don't want to provide the services for a same-sex marriage or civil union, I would expect a gay service provider, whether they're religious or not, to have the flexibility to resist servicing the Westboro Baptist Church. I think the law, the way it's written, it extends religious protections to all people of all religions. It doesn't single out gays, lesbians, and homosexuals.
So you want to give the owner of a gay bar the right to throw out Fred Phelps?
Gay, listen, I live near
to discriminate against
LA.
Fred Phelps.
I live in LA, and gay bars are already doing that. Listen, if they want to be associated with people doing that,
have you ever been in a gay bar?
I actually have.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like that. I've been in gay bars a fair amount. I used to work in one. I used to be a DJ in a gay bar.
I've been to a number of gay bars, and trust me, there is a particular mindset in that particular establishment.
And you've seen people thrown out because they were straight?
I have not seen people thrown out, but I've seen people verbally upgraded for positions that they had that were against gay marriage. Again,
if you're talking about people having conversations in a bar, I mean, welcome to the world of bars. Period.
No, I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is they've been upbraided for it, and they've been close to throwing them out. They haven't thrown them out, but again, this is because people conflate being against the redefinition of marriage with being anti-gay. The two are not one and the same. So, yes, if a business owner does not want to provide services because providing services would infringe upon their sincerely held religious beliefs, that's religious liberty. But to say that we're not going to serve you...
What if my sincerely held religious belief is that you should be wearing a head covering because I am an Orthodox Jew or I'm Muslim and you're not, or that if you are bringing your wife along that her head should be shaved and she should be wearing a wig?
But those situations aren't in front of us. So, I mean, it's almost like a non-issue.
If, you know, as soon as you give a business the right to discriminate based on their religion, you're empowering every kind of wackadoodle religion there is. Not to say that, Judaism or Islam are wackadoodle religions, but I could, you know, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster might, you know, if you're not dressed like a pirate, I'm going to keep you out of my place.
That's true, but it's not religious discrimination. And again, if people read the bill, which is only two pages, the provisions in the bill make it that much harder to use the religious infringement excuse to sue. So, again,
but the whole point of this bill, and the lawmakers who are putting it forward are very clear about this, is to give businesses the right to discriminate against gays. You have to admit that.
No, I'm not going to admit that because I've
But the lawmakers are saying that. The guys who wrote the legislation.
So they're saying they don't want the religion, free exercise of religion to be infringed upon, up to and including business owners and corporations being sued to be forced to provide a service to people who they...
Exactly. They should be able to discriminate without fear of lawsuit.
Without fear of lawsuit, but they're not discriminating on them for simply being gay. Again, that's a conflation.
Okay. Derek Green, nationalcenter.org is the website. Thank you, Derek.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating conversation. So, welcome to the Widget Barn. How can I help you in a totally heterosexual way? Andrew Campbell on the line with us, the senior producer of The Big Picture. Andrew, so our first hour, the Coke-fueled lies. We're starting Block A.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about Harry Reid's comments today on the Senate floor. He had some pretty strong words for the Koch brothers in a new ad that they're airing. Their group, Americans for Prosperity, has put out an ad about a woman with leukemia who is blaming Obamacare for not being able to afford her health care. She says she was kicked off her health plan because of Obamacare. But fact checkers have looked at the ad and they've determined it's completely false. And that's something
it's
that,
largely false.
Largely,
her health insurance did go, you know, and most health insurances, you know, changed at the top of every year. But her health insurance did change as a result of Obamacare. But she qualifies for a policy under Obamacare that would cover her just fine. Thank you very much. And she'd actually save money.
Yeah, her premiums would go down, among other things that would actually benefit her. That's one thing that Harry Reid pointed out on the floor today. But he also said that the Koch brothers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars telling Americans that Obamacare is bad for them. And he went on to say it's easy to do that if you have no conscience and are willing to lie like they are. Wow. So we're going to get into a discussion on if money is speech, according to the Supreme Court, shouldn't we regulate that like we regulate speech and regulate our right to associate? So we'll be getting into that.
That's very interesting. And then that's going to lead to the Lone Liberal Rumble, where we've got two guys from the Heritage Foundation, Cameron Seward and Andrew Kloster.
Yep, we have both of them on. They're always a good combination together, so it should be good. We'll also be talking about the GOP's proposed bill to amend Obamacare. The CBO, Congressional Budget Office, has taken a look at it, and they found that it really doesn't address any issues that Republicans are finding with Obamacare, and if anything, it makes the supposed issues worse. It would add to the nation's deficit. It would kick nearly 1 million people off of employee-offered health care coverage. So it's not a plan. It's a talking point, and it raises the question, when are Republicans actually going to have a plan to fix what they say is it the issuance in Obamacare?
Yeah, it is a good one.
We'll also talk about Congress stalling on unemployment extension. Democrats are working feverishly still to extend it for nearly 1.8 million Americans, but Republicans just aren't budging, so we'll get into that. And we'll also talk about Boeing, which is one of America's largest corporations, not paying a dime in federal income tax last year, despite making billions in profits.
Wow. And paying millions to its CEO and senior executives.
And getting millions in tax subsidies from state and local governments across the country.
Any idea how they did that? Was it using offshore entities or?
The report doesn't talk about offshore. They've just taken advantage of a lot of loopholes in our corporate tax code, which is something else we can talk about, really preventing corporate.
I mean, sometimes companies have a really bad year. Boeing had real problems with the 787 Dreamliner this year.
They had problems with it, but the numbers don't show that.
Did they pay a dividend? That's something to look for. If they paid a dividend this year, then they had a profit. And they, you know, if you're paying a dividend to your stockholders, you should be paying taxes to the federal government.
Yep.
We'll have to check that out. And is that it for the rubble?
We'll also touch on the Senate telling Swiss banks to start being more transparent and stop letting Americans evade taxes.
Great. And then Alec, accessory to murder, and is there any real news left? Jeff Cohen is going to be with us, so it's going to be an interesting evening.
Should be a great show.
Yep. Hey, Andrew, thank you so much. I'll see you tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Harbin here with you. It's just a hysterical little riff over at Daily Kos. It was in their Cheers and Jeers section this morning, so I wasn't able to determine exactly who wrote it. I'll go back and see if I can figure this out to give attribution, but you can see it at dailykos.com. And, you know, you hear the jingle jangle. Somebody comes into the shop, okay. And the shop owner says, "Hello, welcome to Widget Barn. How can I help you in a totally heterosexual way?" And the customer says, "Yes, I'm looking for a widget." Shop owner, "In a totally heterosexual way? Huh? Well, it's my sincere religious belief that I can only serve heterosexuals here. You are heterosexual, I presume." How can you tell? "Well, you drove up in a Chevy pickup. You're wearing a John Deere hat. Those work boots have clearly gotten a workout in the heterosexual dirt." And I'm not lisping. "That too. And I'm not prancing. I'm not dropping any soap. I'm not humming Donna Summer." And the shop owner says, or YMCA. Customer, Well, still, I could be putting on an act. You know how good gays are at acting. I hear Hollywood's full of them. Well, are you gay? I don't know. Am I? I don't know. Customer, your sincerely held religious beliefs forbid you from selling to gays, and you don't even know one when you see one? A shop owner, look, you want a widget or not? Customer, sorry, but my sincerely held religious beliefs forbid me from buying from bigots. Kerslam goes the door. Shop owner, good Lord, the world sure is full of rude people. I'm just trying to figure out, how does this play out, right? I mean, you know, our guest, Derek, wasn't willing to acknowledge that the purpose of this legislation is to allow stores to discriminate against gays, but that's really what it's all about. And other states are, you know, people are unambiguous about this. You've got Louis Gohmert coming out today and going, oh, yeah, of course, that's what it's about. And I mean, seriously, right? Louis Gohmert out there going, we ought to figure out a way to discriminate against them gay people. And it's not a verbatim quote, but it's, you know, you get the point. So my question is, how does this play out? Now, I see, you know, I realize that the cases that provoked this are the ones that Fox News got all in a huff about. And Fox News did story after story after story of the first one, I believe, was a photographer who, when she was told that it was a gay marriage, same-sex marriage that she was going to be shooting, she said, no, thanks, I don't do that. And she got sued. And then there was a store that made wedding cakes, and a same-sex couple came in and said, we'd like a wedding cake. And the shop owner said, no, I don't do wedding cakes for, you know, those kind of marriages. And so they sued the wedding cake store. And what this legislation is intended to do is to prevent those lawsuits, to say you can't sue because you were discriminated against just because you're gay. Now, you can sue if you're discriminated against because you're black, or because you're Hispanic, or because you're Jewish, or because you're Catholic, or because you're, I don't know about the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I don't know what level of protection. Where do the courts draw the lines? I don't know. But increasingly, the courts have been saying, you know, if you go into business, you are in business. You are not in church. And increasingly, the right wingers, you know, this is a very interesting topic. Aside from the kind of funny part of it, and I think, you know, Michael Sam has, if anything, you know, increasingly, as more and more people come out, the quote gay stereotype is, you know, the Liberace stereotype is just being blown apart. And we're discovering, you know, straight people are discovering that gay people come in as many varieties, shapes, sizes, and ways of behaving and living in life as are straight people. So that said, how's a good religious homophobe supposed to conduct themselves? I mean, I get it if you're making wedding cakes and it's a same-sex wedding, or if you're a photographer and it's a same, you know, I get that. But this law would let you just basically stop somebody. You could put a sign up that says, no gays welcome here. We reserve the right to refuse service to anybody under the law of Arizona. That means you, if you're gay, or lesbian, or transgendered, or bisexual, or even uncertain. So how does that work? That, you know, that kind of provides a lot of fodder for a stand-up routine, I suppose. And I'll leave that to Stephanie Miller, who does that kind of thing really well, and who's going to drop by our show, by the way, in a couple of hours. But the thing that really fascinates me about this is that these anti-gay issues, well, go back 60 years, go back 50 years. I remember the 1960s, the late 1950s, early 1960s. I was a kid, but I remember them. And you could, in the South, reliably win elections, at least up until 1964. You could reliably win elections as a Democrat by siding with George Wallace and saying segregation now, segregation, segregation then, segregation now, segregation forever, or whatever his famous phrase was, or axe handle Lester Maddox. So it used to be discrimination against black people would win you, it would turn out the base. 10-15 years ago, turning out the base, be afraid of gay people. What are they going to do now that it's not working?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, the anti-gay marriage laws in Texas just went down with the federal court. This is happening all over the country. What are the Republicans going to do? This is remarkable. You know, this group, The Family, they're here in Washington, D.C. They've got a house on C Street. Senator John Ensign, former Senator Jim DeMint, head of the Heritage Foundation, Senator Tom Coburn, Representative Bart Stupak, have lived at C Street. The Family is this religious group. They are subsidized by you and me. They call themselves a nonprofit, a church, basically. Hillary Clinton described The Family's leader, Doug Coe, as a unique presence in Washington, a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide to anyone, regardless of party or faith, who wants to deepen his or her relationship with God. So, what is The Family all about? Well, The Family and Senator Inhofe have been big promoters of David Bhatti. David Bhatti is a member of the Ugandan Parliament, and according to Jeff Charlotte, and this from an article in today's TheDailyBeast.com by Sally Cohn, who has been a guest on this program, Bhatti has said he wants to kill every last gay person. The Family, by the way, organizes the national prayer breakfast that presidents speak at every year. The Ugandan version of it was organized by Mr. Bhatti, the member of Congress in Uganda, who sponsored this originally, the Kill the Gay Bill, and now the Imprison the Gay Bill. And The Family has contributed millions of dollars to a student leadership program that Bhatti oversees. Jim Inhofe is the official missionary to Uganda for The Family. He's traveled to Africa at least 20 times since 1999, at the cost, by the way, to you and me of $187,000. He's invited Bhatti to the United States 3 times. Inhofe, Sally Cohn writes, who once boasted of being proud that there was not a single gay relationship in the recorded history of our family, also boasted that he adopted Uganda. Bhatti, by the way, hangs out with Martin Sempa, a Ugandan pastor who's also, one of the guys who was promoting this anti-gay law. Sempa was heavily funded by the Bush administration to push abstinence only in Uganda, which led to the reversal of the progress they were making against HIV. No more condoms, just say no. He's spoken out against condoms. He spoke at Pastor Rick Warren's church in California. Rick Warren has said that gay marriage is the equivalent, his phrase, to incest, pedophilia, and polygamy, has said that gay people are, quote, evil, end quote, back in 2008. And this is how much times change. 2008 was only 5 years ago, right? 6 years ago. In 2008, quoting from Sally Cohn in today's Daily Beast, presidential candidate Barack Obama appeared in a forum hosted by Warren at Saddleback Church in which Obama denounced marriage equality. Obama also said, I love the ministries that are taking place here at Saddleback. And then in his first inauguration, he invited Rick Warren to give the convocation. The family has members, at least one Supreme Court justice, generals, Fortune 500 CEOs, and dozens of members of Congress. And yesterday, Red Pepper, which is one of the larger tabloid newspapers in Uganda, posted a list, issued a list of the top 200 gays in Uganda. It is now a crime to be gay in Uganda, so you can bet that those people are literally running for their lives right now. And in the face of this, we've got Georgia wants to pass a you can discriminate against gay laws. Actually, there's like 8 or 10 states that are doing this, and Arizona has already passed it. Will Jan Brewer sign it or veto it? You know, the intelligent money is betting that she'll veto it, but the point is that it's out there, that this is a shout out to the base. Is the base really that bigoted? I think the base is changing, even the Republican base. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, you want to weigh in on this? Paul? Paul is playing music. Okay. I'm going to put Paul on hold. We'll come back to him. Larry in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom. Thanks so much for everything you do.
Sure. Speaking of Arizona.
Well, everybody out. To everybody out there, we're not all sociopathic white people, but somehow we have a lot of sociopathic white people in charge
in Arizona.
And I think yes.
Well, actually, all over this country.
Yeah, and Tom, one of my challenges locally is how does the community address this psychopathic, sociopathic behavior in its leaders? It's like, how do we talk to daddy when he keeps beating us every time we bring it up?
Well, see, the thing is, daddy is genetic. Leadership, political leadership is elected. And so the way you talk to them is at the ballot box. You vote them out. And the way you vote them out is by organizing, is by talking to your friends, talking to your neighbors, speaking out. You know, whether it's at the coffee shop, the supermarket, or, you know, organizing a town hall meeting or starting a blog or writing letters to the editor or showing up at a local, you know, protest movement or whatever it may be, calling member, you know, your state senators and representatives, assuming that Arizona has a Senate and a House of Representatives, contacting Jan Brewer's office, all those kinds of things. That's that, you know. And by the way, you raise, and Larry, thank you for the call. You raise a really, really important issue that I want to riff on a little bit. I was going to get into it in the next hour, but I'll just open the door to this. The Supreme Court has said that money is protected under the First Amendment, the same thing as speech. We regulate speech in the United States. There are words I cannot say to you on the air. My speech is regulated. There are words you cannot say in a crowded movie theater. There are words you can't say to anybody in public without being charged with a crime. It would be considered assault. There are certain words that you can say that are considered assaultive. So we regulate speech. We regulate assembly. Assembly is protected by the First Amendment, too. If you want to have a demonstration, you have to get a permit. So we regulate these things. So why can't we regulate money? And if we're going to regulate money in politics, let's start by saying that the primary regulation is if the money comes from sociopaths or psychopaths or people who have no conscience or people who are willing to lie, that money can be regulated. Harry Reid today, either yesterday afternoon or this morning, I don't recall which, but it's in today's news, came out and said that the Koch brothers are willing to lie in their ads. If somebody's willing to lie in their ads, should their speech be considered legitimate speech? Is that as, you know, or should that be considered illegitimate speech? Is that the equivalent of yelling fire in a crowded theater? Is it harmful to society? And if so, shouldn't it be regulated? Paul, you want to try that again?
Okay, sorry, Tom.
That's okay. it sounded pretty good. Was that you?
Yeah.
Hey, you're good.
I'm trying to practice the, it's actually the piccolo interlude, a part of Popeye the Sailor Man.
That's great.
But you didn't get to hear that part. This is the run that's at the very end.
Oh, yeah, the Warner Brothers rap, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, but...
That's all, folks. Yes, indeed.
Okay. You know, this this thing, that's, this law, this Arizona law, and I was listening to your guest talk about, there's one thing that comes up here that's really fundamental, and that is, this is this contract law. When you open your doors for business, you're making a contractual offer. Just like if you place an ad in the newspaper that says, I'll sell my car to you for $5,000. You can't say to Christian buyers only. So when you open your doors as a florist or as a baker, you're making an offer. When I walk in, I don't care who you are, and I say I want that. That's an acceptance. You have to sell it to me. Just like if you put your car in the paper for $5,000, I show up at your house and say, I want to buy the car, here's $5,000. You have to sell it to me.
No, you're absolutely right. And actually, I mean, you know, you can withdraw the offer and things like that. But the point is that the parameters of that offer and the acceptance of that offer and how that can be adjudicated are defined by law. And
right.
So what this law is in Arizona is an attempt to redefine the parameters of commercial intercourse, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And let me, I want to get something in here quick that I've been trying to get to. This about the Confederate flag on the Arizona license plates.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a case called, it was the famous Ollie's Barbecue case, Katzenbach versus McClung in 1964, where they were not allowing black patrons to be seated in the barbecue place. They could take out, but they wouldn't seat them. And John Katzenbach, who was the attorney general at the time, took it to the Supreme Court and said that you're interfering with interstate commerce because you get some of your supplies from out of state.
Right.
And then what happened was the courts, McClung argued, well, we don't even get that much, so that's not a big part of it. And the court agreed that, well, yeah, you don't really get that much, so that's not a big deal. But the fact that you are discriminating against black people is interfering with interstate commerce because you're right on the freeway. So my angle is this. If you come into my business in Washington State with a Confederate flag on your license plate, you're interfering with my business because people pull into my parking lot and see that, they're likely to turn around and leave.
Excellent point, Paul. Excellent.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And congratulations, Paul. You said it before we hit the break. We'll be right back 15 minutes before the hour. And welcome back. Cynthia in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Cynthia.
Wow, that's awesome.
What's that?
Okay, so I agree with the Piccolo guy.
And uh-huh.
I have an example. When I was in high school, I went to a religious high school, and there was only two high schools in this really big city that I lived in. And it was religious, but we were over $2 million in debt. And so we've had other people come in who were different religions, mm-hmm. and we accepted them. I mean, we were told we weren't supposed to, but we did because we needed the money and we gave the best education in the town.
Yeah, I remember, you know, growing up in Lansing, Michigan, where there weren't any private schools that I know of other than the Catholic private school. And I know some kids who were Protestant, some families who were Protestant who sent their kids to the Catholic school because they thought it was better than the public school, even though they weren't Catholic.
That's all, my opinion is that if you are making a business and you're supposed to be open, you shouldn't
discriminate
push people away because they're different. Yeah,
yeah,
sorry.
Based on your own religion. See, I think it's okay for a church to discriminate based on religion, because churches are all about religion. So a Catholic church can say, I'm a Catholic priest. I'm not going to perform a wedding for a Protestant couple. Or a rabbi can say, I'm not going to do a wedding for a Catholic couple. That all makes sense to me. That's outside the boundaries of civil law. That's really religion to religion. But when we're talking about simple contract stuff, simple commerce. I'm coming into a hardware store and I want to buy a screwdriver. I'm coming into a bakery and I want to buy a wedding cake. When we're talking about simple commerce, to inject religion into it, in my opinion, it's just wrong. I mean, I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's wrong. It's antithetical to the principles on which this country was founded, which were purely secular. In fact, our Constitution says there shall be no religious test for any position or office. And the government's not going to interfere in religion. And in this case, I think the government would actually be, interfering on behalf of religion, which is kind of a dangerous thing. So
they're not going to make money if they just push everybody away. Then there's no point of being a business.
Well, and that's the argument, Cynthia, that the people who are promoting this law make is they're saying, well, if somebody's hostile to gay people don't want to go there anyway. And that's the argument that they used to make, the segregationists used to make. Well, everybody knows that this is a redneck restaurant full of angry white people. What African-American would want to walk in here? And it's not a question of would they want to or is it good or bad business. It's a question of do people have the right to be in that place of business? And basically, everybody, if somebody's open for business, everybody should have the right to go into that place of business and participate. And so it's about the individual's right. And what they're trying to do is basically say that the business's religious rights, and I didn't know the businesses had religion, unless they happen to be churches, that the business's religious rights supersede those of the individual. And I think that that's the opposite of essentially what our Constitution says. Cynthia, thank you for the call. Very, very good point. 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. The place where smart people get their news, the Tom Harbin Program. Matt in Denver. Hey, Matt, thanks for listening to AM 760. You agree with this law?
Yeah, and I can hear the skepticism in your voice, but let me give you a little context up front. I identify as bisexual myself. I'm actually active in the Denver Gay and Lesbian Chamber of Commerce as an ambassador. Have been for years. But I do think that a small business, I actually like the idea of anti-gay businesses making themselves known. And the biggest reason is that the court of public opinion is weighing in on the anti-gay thing, and right, those folks are losing. If I went into a shop and I was holding hands with a boy and they told me to get lost, I would do the same thing anyone with a smartphone would do. I would take a video of it, throw it on YouTube. I'd put a review on Yelp. I'd put it up on Facebook. And really, my suspicion is those people would lose more revenue than they would gain in loyalty.
Yeah, but you're making the argument that Richard Nixon was making in his debate with John Kennedy back in 1960, that the marketplace should decide these things. And Kennedy's response was, no, it's wrong. It's just wrong. If somebody is in business, they have to be in business for everybody, because we, the people, we, the government of the United States, all of us, we are extending benefits to that business. We are extending tax benefits to that business. We are extending legal protections to that business. We're extending limits of liability to the owners of that business and the stockholders of that business. We are giving all of us, including the gay people, including the black people, we are giving those to that business owner. And therefore, that business owner has an obligation, a requirement to make that business available to all of us.
Try
to knock that down.
When you make an analogy to sort of like the African American movement, it sounds like a much stronger argument. But the plight of gays in this country, although there continue to be several civil rights issues that we continue to face, it's not literally the same thing. We were never plucked from another continent and shipped overseas, and we were never made to be slaves and so forth. It's just not.
But the same is true of people who came to this country from Africa and are first, second, third, fourth generation immigrants, but still they're treated in contemporary society the same way. I mean, Barack Obama has no slavery in his ancestry, and yet he himself tells stories of, walking by and having people lock their cars. So, it's not limited. This has nothing to do with the history of slavery. I mean, this history of slavery informs this, but this is not specifically about that. We're not talking about reparations here.
Sure. Yeah, I guess, the bottom line, as far as I feel, is, you may have some point that because the public does extend infrastructure and other sorts of benefits to these businesses, maybe lawfully they can't do it. But conceptually, if I would gleefully withhold my bid. I look forward to the opportunity to finding out which businesses are owned by bigots, because it allows me, my social network, and anybody that I have influence over to withhold my business from them. I think that's fantastic.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but you, I believe that you should also have the legal right to have, you know, some say in that, in that sort of thing, and you know, participate with that. So, Matt, thank you for the call. Jerry in Boonville, Indiana. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Hey, I'm just calling about the anti-gay legislation in Uganda, mm-hmm. and I want to know, is there any accountability for senators that actively promote overseas, especially, you know, if it results in the lifelong incarceration or death of the foreign citizens?
Yeah. I think Jim Inhofe should be held accountable in the court of public opinion, if nothing else. And
what about the Ethics Committee?
Yeah, as well, but it hasn't happened so far. I mean, it's well, the Ethics Committee, I don't know that he has breached Senate ethics, but I think that this is, you know, this kind of falls into the category of what the previous caller said, which is, you know, let's you know, get the clip and call him out. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. This is Jack Kennedy and Richard Nixon talking about, you know, what do you do about the lunch counter thing? And here we go.
Talk to Negro mothers.
First, they asked Nixon, "What are you going to do about these, you know, these businesses that are refusing to serve black people?"
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
So basically, Nixon's answer was, we will jawbone them, not we will hold them accountable under the law. So then they turned to Senator Kennedy and said, what's your response? And he basically said, I will use the law to kick their ass.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. It's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he would support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in schools. About 2% of our population of white people is illiterate. 10% of our colored population. 60 to 70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions in these areas that the North and the Southeast and West are entitled to know. What will be the leadership of the President in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment, equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal-supported housing by a stroke of the President's pen? What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the President must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected President, we will do so.
There you go. That, you know, from the Nixon, from the JFK library, and from the Nixon Kennedy debates, obviously, and this is not that different. It's like, are we going to just sit back and say, oh, we'll let the marketplace decide, and then put the thumb on the scale of the bigots with this law, the legal thumb on the scale of the bigots with this law that Arizona has passed, or are we going to say, sorry, we're giving you business. We're giving you certain rights and privileges in exchange for that. You serve all of us.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And, you know, I have read now the Arizona law, Senate Bill 1062, the proposed law. It'll be a law if the governor signs it. And there's variations of this being introduced in state legislatures all over the country. And basically it makes a very, very significant rewrite of the state's laws. The state basically says in the original law that a religious organization may deny services to other religious organizations or people of other religions based on their religion. Now, that actually makes sense. Okay, the original law, under the original law, it simply says person includes a religious assembly or institution. That's what the original law said. And basically what it said was that if you're the Catholic Church, you can say to a couple who are members of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster that you're not going to perform their wedding. And you shall not be burdened by the state. The actual language, if I can find it in my stack here we go. The actual language of the burden by the state is state action shall not substantially burden a person. Now keep in mind, person is defined in the very first part in definitions in the original law. Person is defined as a religious assembly or institution. So for the purposes of this law, originally it was just churches. The state or religious institutions, monasteries. The state shall not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability. And you have, you know, and then they go through a whole bunch of basic legalese. But here's the kicker. They changed that definition. In Article 41-1493 definitions, paragraph 5, person, now, instead of being a religious assembly or institution, now is any individual, association, partnership, corporation, church, religious assembly, or institution, or other business organization. So now, your local hardware store, your bake shop, I mean, obviously this is targeted to wedding chapels that are totally sectarian, that are not affiliated with any church, that just do non-denominational weddings. Places that may rent out wedding halls, reception halls, a bar where you might have a bachelor party or a bachelorette party or whatever you call it, photographers. I mean, these are the cases that have gone before the courts, but obviously they want to extend, you know, once this law is passed, it can be extended wildly. So that's how this law works. And that's what they're doing. And this goes back to, and the case, by the way, which was lost by this Christian-owned bakery in Oregon, which was hit with a fine for refusing to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple that came into them. The Sarah Jean Seaman, writing over at townhall.com, notes the Bureau of Labor and Industries found the bakery, and this is from the ruling that hit the bakery with the fines. The bakery is not a religious institution under the law. And the business's policy of refusing to make same-sex wedding cakes represents unlawful discrimination based on sexual orientation. So the state of Arizona changed the law. They said what the laws that originally applied to only religious assemblies or institutions now apply to any individual association, partnership, corporation, church, religious assembly, or institution, or other business organization. It's pretty straightforward stuff. Tucker Carlson, whose dad, I think, used to run the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I think that's how he, as I recall, Tucker Carlson was on Fox, and he said, "This is fascism. When you try and force me to bake a cake for your gay wedding and threaten me with prison." Actually, it wasn't prison. It was fines. This is not criminal law. This is civil law. But anyhow, "When you try to force me to bake a cake for your gay wedding and threaten me with prison, if I don't, that's called fascism." Right. I mean, this is the argument that George Wallace used to make. "That fascist Bobby Kennedy is coming down here to the South and telling us that we have to let those people sit at our lunch counters." Right. I mean, it's still the same language. It's just those people has shifted from one group of those people to another group of those people. Okay, I wanted to share that with you. I told you at the beginning of the show also, I wanted to get into the, are we in a bubble yet? And this I found fascinating, the starry state of corporate taxes in America. Piece in the Financial Times today about how Tesla Motors, one analyst, see this, let me back up a little before I share this story with you. Here's the problem. Reagan cut taxes on the rich. And actually, there was one point where, during the Reagan presidency, where capital gains taxes and regular income taxes were the same. They were both at 28%, but they were the same. So, and Reagan changed the rules for compensation so that CEOs could be compensated with stock. It used to be against the law, against the tax law. So CEOs and senior executives can be compensated with stock. So they get over that $1 or $2 million limit that the IRS places on executive pay that's deductible to the corporation. So the net of this is, because of the Reagan tax cuts, for 32 years now, there's been all this hot money being injected into the system, which has caused a whole series of bubble and bursts. Boom, bust, boom, bust. The dot-com boom, then the bust. The tech boom, then the bust. The housing boom, then the bust. The, stock market boom, then the bust. So back to this piece in the Financial Times. They're talking about Tesla Motor, and one Wall Street analyst wrote an article saying, Tesla's stock is probably going to double in price over the course of the next year. Now, as Richard Waters in San Francisco and Henry Foy in London point out for this article, that, this suggestion by Mr. Jonas, the forecast, means that Tesla is going to become, arguably, he says the bold call added around $5 billion to Tesla's market value. And that, Tesla's stock, it means, that would value the company at more than the almost $60 billion market value of General Motors, even though Tesla only plans to deliver 35,000 electric sedans this year compared to GM's 10 million cars. Now, when a company that's, I love Tesla, I've been in one, and they're wonderful cars. But when a company who sells 35,000 cars a year has the same market value in the stock market as a company that sells 10 million cars, you're in a bubble. And that's the point that they're making. And they point out back in 1998, when we were in a bubble, the little-known analyst named Henry Blodgett said Amazon's going to go to 400. And the stock jumped up 19% on a single day and eventually did hit 400. But the analyst said that his call was, quote, like throwing gasoline on a bonfire. All this tells me the crash of 2016 is still underway.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's why I wrote the book of the same title, but also I'm just saying it could happen next week. It could happen next year. It certainly is going to happen by November of 2016. In fact, to add to that, David Garrity, a leading Wall Street autos analyst who is now principal of GVA Research, Richard Waters and Henry Foy write for the Financial Times. I just missed it. I just lost it. Where did it go? Oh, yeah, here it is. Perhaps as a result, Facebook's WhatsApp acquisition last week, people are boldly going where no one has gone before. People are fervid in their imaginations about where things can go. That's a bubble market. That's because there's hot money sloshing around. So, anyway, let's pick up some calls here. Dan in Spokane, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dan, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good.
I've got a short comment, and then I'll get off the line. And
sure.
I haven't heard anybody mention, since this would be a state law, does this law not do away with the separation of church and state?
Well,
that's
a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
At least imposes towards that direction, doing away with separation of church and state, and then who knows where it'll go from there.
Yeah. I mean, what the First Amendment says is that there shall be, that basically that the state is not going to promote any particular religion. In fact, let me just read it. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So, we're not going to make a law saying this is the official religion of the United States.
Can't hear him anymore.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Huh?
You can't hear me? Okay. Let me drop the call then, and you can just listen to me on TV. Congress shall make no law regarding an establishment of religion. That's what the First Amendment says. So that separation of church and state is language that was from a letter James Madison wrote to Thomas Jefferson. It's not about it's not in the Constitution, but the effect of it is the First Amendment, that there is that wall of separation between church and state. And actually what this is doing, because the state recognizes churches in a particular way and allows them to discriminate in particular ways and gives them certain tax advantages, and then recognizes secular corporations in a somewhat different way and gives them tax advantages and allows them to behave in certain ways which don't include discrimination.
We've lost the internet.
Okay, we're still on the radio. Okay, we'll be rebooting here shortly. We're down. The wonders of our internet service provider here in Washington D.C. In any case, to finish this thought, it's suggesting that I don't think that this is something that you could argue before the Supreme Court as a violation of the First Amendment, because this is not the establishment of a religion. It's the establishment of the right of religious entities. It's the right of corporate entities to discriminate as if they were religious entities. And that's pretty iffy. But I don't think it's a First Amendment case. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour, and I think we need to clear our lines because our internet crashed, which kind of crashes everything here. Not everything. It's kind of a pain in the butt anyway. Except our radio, which is provided by ISDN. So anyhow, the point that I was making is that I think that in fact, I'm going to close my call screen software in the event that Danielle is going to reboot everything. So let me just close out of that. And And I'm going to restart this PC as well because my everything has been my chat room got clogged up too. So anyhow, this thing of Tesla, they point to Facebook's acquisition of WhatsApp. I mean, this is a little company that had an app with 55 employees, and you know, the New York Times columnist, I think it was Tom Friedman was writing about how, you know, oh gee, look at this, they're bigger than Twitter, and so they're worth lots and lots of money, and they even have a way of monetizing. But still, you know, $5 billion. You know, Tesla is worth more than General Motors. It's a pretty dicey thing, and so the whole point, or one of the two points, one of the two major points of the crash of 2016 was that you see these bubbles happen when there is hot money in the system. Now, what produces hot money in the system? Sudden influxes of wealth. Now, there have been precedents for this. For example, in Spain, in the early 1500s, the Spanish conquistadors who had landed in Central and South America, particularly Central America, started bringing back Aztec and Inca gold to Spain. There was this incredible, insane gold rush. And the outcome of that was that the economy of Spain just started exploding, and it eventually crashed. You know, as the gold coming in collapsed, the Spanish economy crashed. It's not that different when you have, in terms of money, sloshing around in the investment world, and you know, the price of things being bid up. It's not that different when you have a situation like with Reagan cutting taxes on the very, very rich, and suddenly the very, very rich have a lot more money. That money is, and it's like money that they didn't have to work that hard to get. It's like, you know, gee, let's make $1 million an hour. Let's make $2 million an hour. I mean, that's an actual practical reality right now in America. And it wasn't before the Reagan administration, by and large. And so the question becomes, how do we prevent these things from happening? I think, frankly, we need to roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Pretty straightforward stuff. The sorry state of corporate taxes, why Fortune 500 firms pay or don't pay in the U.S. This is a study that was put together by Robert McIntyre. And by the way, Nigel, if you happen to be listening, our community link on that homepage ought to have the chat room as well on it. So you can go right into chat with a single click off our homepage, in my humble opinion. Anyhow, the executive summary, some key findings. As a group, 288 corporations paid an effective federal tax rate of 19.4%, far less than the 35% actual rate. 26 of the corporations, including Boeing, General Electric, Priceline.com, and Verizon, paid no federal income tax at all over a five-year period. A third of the corporations, 93 of them, paid an effective tax rate of less than 10% over that period. And those with significant offshore profits, two-thirds paid higher corporate tax rates to foreign governments where they operate than they paid in the U.S. on their U.S. profits. So that's where you get these guys going, oh yeah, you know, in corporate, offshore, everybody, you know, every country in the world's got lower taxes than we do for corporations. Well, the fact of the matter is that the companies in the United States who are doing business offshore and are showing a profit offshore and are paying corporate taxes offshore are paying a higher tax rate than they are here in the U.S. So why do they continue going overseas? Because they don't have to comply with workplace protection rules, because they don't have to comply with environmental protection rules, because they can pollute all they want and they can externalize all their costs, because they don't have to pay their workers squat. Now, conservatives would have you think that it's all about the corporate tax rate in the United States. Oh, we've got to cut the corporate tax rate. It's not about the corporate tax rate. It's got nothing to do with the corporate tax rate. It is all about those other issues. And so because you know, corporations and rich people and conservatives have dominated this conversation, we have this situation where 111 of the 288 companies paid zero or less. In other words, many of them got subsidies in federal income taxes in at least 1 year from 2008 to 2012. 39%. Four out of six, two out of five companies in America in the last 5 years paid nothing in federal taxes. Financial services, 18% of companies paid no taxes. Aerospace and defense, 16%. The defense contractors, 16% of them paid nothing in taxes. Transportation, that'd be the airlines, things like that, 16% of them paid no taxes. Oil, gas, and pipelines, 14% of them paid no taxes. Telecommunications, 9%. The tax breaks claimed by these companies are highly concentrated in the hands of a very few large corporations. Just 25 companies claimed $174 billion in tax breaks over the 5 years from 2008 to 2012. That's almost half of the $364 billion in total tax subsidies claimed by all 288 companies. Five companies, Wells Fargo, AT&T, IBM, General Electric, and Verizon, got $77 billion in tax breaks during that five-year period. Just five corporations. $77 billion, not million, billion.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, you know, how the heck does the Tom Hartman get $77 billion in tax subsidies, tax breaks? I don't know. We can't do that. We're just a small business. The good, the bad, and the very, very hypnopompically ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com. The good, Michelle Obama. On Tuesday, the First Lady and Secretary of Agriculture John Vilsack announced that the government would extend its pilot program, giving all students at select schools access to free lunches and free breakfasts. Starting on July 11th, the program will expand to 22,000 individual schools across the United States. The Obama administration estimates that the expansion will help 9 million kids gain access to affordable hot meals. Living a healthy lifestyle starts with not having to worry about where your next meal comes from. Good on Michelle Obama for making sure fewer American kids have to worry about that. The bad. Michael Pristup, the Annapolis, Maryland fire chief, is under fire today for using a hoax story to testify against legalizing marijuana. During a Maryland Senate hearing yesterday, Pristup told lawmakers that Colorado saw 37 deaths from marijuana overdose on the day the drug was legalized. Almost as soon as the chief finished speaking, State Senator Jamie Raskin called him out for his dishonesty. Chris Stoop's story about 37 people dying from marijuana overdoses actually came from the joke site, The Daily Current. And the reason, of course, that it came from a joke site is that no one ever overdoses from marijuana. But Chief Pristup is apparently too interested in carrying on the failed war on drugs to bother dealing with pesky things like facts. And the very, very ugly, Rush Limbaugh. During Tuesday's episode of his radio show, the right-wing talk show host blasted the gay lobby for bullying Arizona Governor Jan Brewer into vetoing her state's newest discrimination law, Senate Bill 1062. Take a listen.
All of a sudden now the left is interested in morality, at least as they define it. But you notice here, folks, how bullying is a good thing? The governor of Arizona is being bullied. She's being bullied by the homosexual lobby in Arizona and elsewhere in order to advance the gay agenda. I guess in that circumstance, bullying is admirable.
Yeah. As usual, Rush is just spewing nonsense. Concern about family values? How many wives has he had? Opponents of Arizona's discrimination, many of whom are not gay and just believe in a little thing called human rights, are not bullying Jan Brewer. They're using their First Amendment rights to stop other bigots from bullying and discriminating against gay people. The fact that so many people still take Rush seriously when he says stuff like that is just very, very ugly. It's mind-bogglingly ugly. Okay, so the state of Ohio... Actually, I'm going to get to that in a little bit. Let's pick up some of your calls here. Jim in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was in the military 8 years regular and another 7 reserves. And most of the people in the military, I found out, well, from the Army side, from a few gay friends that I had, that there's more gays in the Army than any other profession.
Yeah.
And you don't want to turn the Army into club gay.
Why not?
Why you don't have the don't ask, don't tell, because...
Well, we don't have don't ask, don't tell anymore. Gays can openly serve in the military, and I haven't seen it collapse. They've been openly serving in the military in Israel for a decade. I haven't seen a collapse there.
Yeah, well, the Army's a dictatorship defending a democracy. And, you know, you basically...
No, it's a socialist state defending a democracy.
Yeah.
The Army is actually, it's communist. They own your clothes. They own where you live. They provide you with medical. They provide you with free education, free medical, free housing. But they own it all. Yeah. But in any case,
it's not all free. But and they're even talking about taking that away.
Yeah.
I think you even mentioned it. But
what's your point?
No, it's like, what if you have a restaurant and it turns into a gay hangout? I mean, you're sitting there and all they want you to do is come in and order a cup of coffee, and they turn into a dive. You know, shouldn't you be able to refuse people service, saying, hey, you know, I don't want you hanging around here waiting to pick somebody up, you know?
Are you serious?
I can see their point there.
Do you really? I mean, there are gay bars. There are places that are you know, specifically catered to that clientele. I mean, that's sort of like saying, you know, what if you own a restaurant and bikers start hanging out there? And, oh, my God, my restaurant is turning into a biker bar. Bikers... You know, there are people who are specifically catering to bikers for biker bars. On the other hand, does that mean that you're going to say to anybody who's got a motorcycle parked out in front, no, we won't serve you because I'm afraid that someday this place is going to become a biker bar? Really?
That's not how
commerce works, Jim.
Mature men, you know, with wives.
I beg your pardon?
Sometimes. So a lot of these bikers are, you know, older, mature men. They're adults. They're not, you know, gang members, basically, you know. You're talking about biker gangs, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't want a biker gang hanging out in your bar, you know.
Unless you were running a biker gang bar, in which case you might. But the point is that aren't, you know, if somebody is opening a business, if you're running a business, and you are getting benefits from the government, you are able to deduct the cost of your wages, the cost of your rent, the cost of doing business from your taxes. Your liability is limited to your investment. You have limitations of liability. You have special tax treatment. You have access to the courts at no cost to adjudicate contracts with your suppliers and pretty much anybody else that you may happen to enter into a contract with. And the vast majority of our courts are used by businesses, and we pay for them with our tax dollars. If you're running a business and you're doing it under rules established by we the people, all of us, including gay people and bikers and black people and everybody else, then you have to serve everybody.
Yeah,
you know, unless somebody is,
I mean,
there are public nuisance laws. If somebody comes in drunk, then they're actually in violation of the law, and you have a legitimate reason to refuse service to them. If somebody comes,
could you say they're loitering? That'd be the other thing. Can you say they're just loitering here, waiting? You know, to
I think you might be able to make a case on that. You know, if whether it's gay people or whether it's bikers or whether it's whatever. But, you know, if people are just sitting there for hours and hours, although, you know, the lunch counter sit-in down in Selma, they tried that, or was it in Birmingham? They tried that, you know, using the loitering laws. Nah, it didn't work so well. But, Jim, these are not arguments that are going to work. Yeah, you know, thanks for the call. Isaiah in Chicago. Hey, Isaiah, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up? Isaiah? Uh-oh. David in Chicago. Can you hear me, David? Oh, I'll bet we lost our internet again. Huh. Well, yeah, we've lost the stream. There it goes. Okay. Well, back to me. and the story that I started to tell you earlier. So the state of Ohio is run by Republicans. And John Husted, who is the Republican Secretary of State, following in the fine footsteps of Ken Blackwell, the former Republican Secretary of State and, you know, Republican all around, let's make sure Republicans win back in the 2004 election. John Husted has noticed that in Cuyahoga County, that African-American voters make up 56% of all the weekend voters in Cuyahoga County. Now, Cuyahoga County is the largest county in Ohio. And even though African-Americans are only 28% of that county's population, they make up more than, they're about a quarter of the population, they make up more than half of the voters on weekends, mostly on Sundays. Because the black churches have this thing called, you know, souls to the polls. They, you know, people go to church, and then after they go to church, they all go vote. And so, like a good Republican, John Husted noticed this and said, holy cow, a lot of black people voting on Saturday and Sunday. Let's do away with that. Let's make it so that there's no Sunday voting. And so they did. A federal appeals court back in 2012, Husted has similarly tried to cut voting hours, this from Think Progress, and a federal appeals court concluded that that directive would, quote, mean thousands of voters who would have voted during those 3 days will not be able to exercise the right to cast a vote in person. But he has followed through. He announced yesterday that he is eliminating extended early voting hours. He's on weekends as the final 2 days before the election, as well as Sunday voting. So this is now the official position. I mean, this is Lark says craven and despicable over at Democratic Underground. I would say that if anything, is an understatement. This is truly craven and despicable. Meanwhile, in Texas, I mentioned that a federal judge has said that the marriage ban in Texas, the gay marriage ban in Texas, is unconstitutional. However, U.S. District Judge Orlando Garcia also issued a stay along with his ruling. In other words, he said, I think this is unconstitutional, but I know that the state is going to appeal this, so I'm going to leave the ban in place until the appeal has been heard. So gay marriage is not happening in Texas today, even though a federal judge has said it's unconstitutional. Step by step. I should point out the parallels between this and Roe v. Wade, perhaps in the next segment. We'll be back in 5 minutes here on the Tom Hartman Program, 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of the news of the day, my take on it, your take on my take, right after this. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And I think our phones are working again, but I just want to recap some of the things that we've covered. I find it fascinating. First of all, and a heads up, at the top of the hour or 6 minutes after the hour when we come back after the news, we are going to be talking about money and banks and depressions and all kinds of, you know, fascinating things in that arena. But I was just, you know, pointing out that, you know, there's all these companies that are paying basically no taxes whatsoever. And of the companies, this is the Starry State of Corporate Taxes is the name of the report. It's from the Citizens for Tax Justice and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. It's a report that just came out a day or so ago. Of those corporations with significant offshore profits, two-thirds paid higher corporate taxes to foreign governments where they operate than they paid in the U.S. on their U.S. profits. Really? I thought companies left America because our taxes were too high. No, they actually pay more taxes overseas. Conservative talking points dying. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I want to weigh in on this tax policy. I'm really glad you brought that up because people don't realize that it's really tied in with trade and global foreign foreign worker arbitrage. But to get to the point about taxes, I want to appoint to you, bring to your attention an article from one of the most leftist pinko commie publications, CFO Magazine.
That's in Chief Financial Officer Magazine, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. That's the ironic comment. From August 17, 2005, HP brings home money, but not jobs. If you recall, the American Jobs Creation Act was passed in 2004 to, as the title would suggest to the bill, create jobs. Well, guess what?
But all it was a tax cut act.
Well, what it was, I'll get to the point. HP brought back $14 billion and then shed 14,000 jobs.
Right.
So that, so much for your tax reform. But I also want to bring to your attention the hearing from last May 21st, 2013, the Senate Committee Homeland Security and Government Affairs hearing, where Apple CEO Tom Cook went before the committee to talk about U.S. tax code and offshore holdings. Mm-hmm. So and then to bring to the issue that I've raised before, Section 1706, between 1987 and in 2011, there were several reports from the New York Times, including three from David K. Johnston, on the IRS code, Section 1706, that imposed restrictions on individuals working directly with corporations, so that Uncle Sam, in an erroneous belief that they would collect all their taxes, set up this Chinese firewall to prevent individuals working directly with corporations. It's really put a damper on, especially on tech contracting and individuals going directly to corporations. And David K. Johnston has written about this extensively.
Yeah. He's brilliant. He's absolutely
He's really had a great insight on that. And then the last item I want to bring to you, of course, is Social Security. If you recall, there was Alan Greenspan appointed to the Social Security Tax Commission, shifting the tax burden to the middle class, and then his reward being appointed to the Federal Reserve for a 19-year run, where all he could do is basically create bubbles during his tenure. So that's kind of a tax policy as I've seen it for the last 20 years or so, 25 years. And basically we have an ordinate shift to the middle class on taxes. We have workers being shafted when it comes to taxes. And we see corporations playing games, shifting their money all around the globe to avoid paying taxes. I find this report very interesting. I look forward to reading it. And I also want to bring I'm trying to find this other story, one last item. Oh, yeah, Professor Alan Smith, emeritus from Eastern Illinois University, actually wrote a story about the Social Security tax shift in April 14th, 2010, on dissidentvoice.org. And basically, the name of his blog was How Ronald Reagan and Alan Greenspan Pulled Off the Greatest Fraud Ever Perpetrated Against the American People.
Yeah. And it's absolutely true. David, thank you for the call. Leon in Heathsville, Virginia. Hey, Leon.
Hey, Tom. Good to talk to you. Sorry about the cold.
Quite
anyway,
right.
This law, it's a fine example of the evil of ignorance.
The Arizona you can discriminate against gays law.
Right. What would we do without authors like Edward Gibbon, Walt Whitman, Truman Capote, and others? You can go down a list of 1,000 if you wanted to. I think we ought to celebrate the intelligence of different groups rather than denigrate them.
I agree. I agree. Where would we be without gay people there? And so many, in our history who were gay or bisexual and we didn't even know, right? I mean, there's at least one president, I believe it was Buchanan, is believed to, there's a fairly high level of certainty that he was gay. There's some evidence that Lincoln might have been bisexual, but it's just like it has been so don't go there for so long that the real contributions of gay people to civilization, to arts, to sciences, to our world are not even known. But I'm with you. We should be celebrating them. Thank you for the call,
yeah.
Leon. Isaiah, we got a half a minute left. Isaiah, you wanted to make a quick comment on the minimum wage?
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of people, and they believe that increasing the minimum wage will kill jobs, but at least those are the talking points. But I believe that they will increase the minimum wage because of the extra $3 or whatever that will be gained from it will in turn create jobs, just as unemployment insurance.
That's what's always happened in the past, Isaiah. If you look at the history of the minimum wage, every time it's been raised, the economy is stimulated, and that causes more jobs to be created.
Exactly. And and along with Obama arguing the idea of the minimum wage being needed for sort of a living wage, which I think it should be like $15, but he should also argue that the direct impact of those money spurring job growth and call the other side job killers, because those are at least their talking points.
Yeah, I'm with you. These job-killing tax cuts ever since Reaganomics. Bush said his tax cuts were going to create jobs. No, they killed jobs. Reagan said his tax cuts were going to create jobs. No. Job creation in the 80s was below the 70s. Thank you, Isaiah.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and Dr. L. Randall Ray is with us, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, senior scholar with the Levy Economics Institute, and writes over at economicmonitor.com/LRWRAY. Dr. Ray, welcome back to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on again.
Thanks so much for joining us, and am I glad this is working. I wanted to. We've been having some problems here with our telephone system. I wanted to talk with you. There's a bunch of stuff that I would love to get into with you, but what caught my eye was this piece that I read over at the Economic Monitor, your Great Leap Forward blog, about Minsky on banking and the difference between the horizontalists, Paul Krugman and whatnot, and Minsky's approach to money and the financial instability hypothesis. Can you reduce this to plain English for us? This debate, this discussion that's going on in economic circles about different ways of looking at how banks participate in the economy.
Yeah. So basically, there are two parts to the argument here. One is that in the 1950s, when we came out of World War II, we actually had a very stable and simple financial system. But Minsky understood that over time it would evolve and evolve in a way that would make a financial crisis possible again.
Right. Now, we should add, Minsky was a famous economist who has since died. His first name was
Hyman P. Minsky.
Thank you.
Yes.
And you actually pulled together some of his writings after he died and got them published and whatnot. I mean, you're quite a scholar of Dr. Minsky.
Yeah, that's right. I wrote my dissertation under him. So I worked with him from very early 80s until he died in 1996.
Right. And he invented the word derivatives, didn't he?
Oh, that I don't know.
He was one of the first to write about them.
He was one of the first to write about securitization.
Oh, securitization. Thank you.
Yeah, Yeah, the whole thing about taking a whole bunch of mortgages and packaging them together and then selling that off to, say, pension funds.
Right.
So anyway, he argued that the economy would evolve and become unstable again like it had done in 1929, and that would make a great crash or a global financial crisis, which is what we had, happen again. Mm-hmm. And he saw that coming in the 50s. That's what's so amazing about it. Then the second aspect is just understanding how financial institutions, or we could say more narrowly banks, operate. And again, he was so far ahead of his time. Here we are 60 years later. Paul Krugman doesn't have a clue how banks operate. This is, you know, even more remarkable than we had economists all over the place who couldn't see the crisis coming, mm-hmm. but they still don't even understand how a bank operates.
So what is the missing piece of Professor Krugman's analysis of banks that Dr. Minsky had?
Well, you know, Krugman still thinks that a bank sits there and it waits for you to bring in, you know, a wheelbarrow full of cash. It puts that on deposit for you, and then it lends some out to borrowers.
Or even lends a multiple of that out.
Yeah. Well, not an indice, in his view. The individual bank can't lend more than it took in.
Hmm.
And so banks cannot create money. This is his argument.
I thought that's how all money was created, was by banks.
Well, almost all money. The sovereign currency issuer also creates money.
Right.
It creates our coins, it creates our paper money, and it creates what are called bank reserves. That's all created by the government.
Right, but that's the baseline. Yeah, but beyond that baseline, as money is increasingly created, or for that matter destroyed, it's by banks lending it into existence or closing those loans out and sucking it back out of existence with the tidy little interest in their pockets.
Yeah, that would be, you know, the vast, vast majority of the money that is created. And so what Minsky said is, no, banks don't operate that way. The way that a bank operates is that it makes a loan by writing an IOU. It writes an IOU. That IOU is called a bank deposit. But in a sense, any of us can create money. I can write, I owe you, Tom, $5. Okay, and I have just now created money.
Right.
Now, if I'm a really famous person and people trust me and they think I'm credit worthy and good for that $5, you might even be able to spend my IOU.
You're right.
And, so I'm not saying, you know, that my IOU is as good as Bank of America's. It's not.
Mm-hmm.
So banks are special in the sense that their IOUs are more widely accepted than mine are. But they can create money just like I can by crediting your bank account with their IOU.
Right. So when we put money on deposit in a bank, it's not that we've put money into the bank. It's that the bank owes us for that money.
That's right. And almost always the money you put into a bank actually is already a bank's IOU. It's the IOU.
So what's the significance of this? Why is it important for everybody to understand this?
Well, because then you start thinking about, well, hold it a second. Okay, so banks can create money. And, you know, what would be prudent behavior of a bank that's creating money? And so in the piece that I wrote that you read, I talked about there are two things that banks really need to be careful about. One we call liquidity, and the other we call solvency.
Mm-hmm.
So if they make loans and create deposits, and then it turns out that all of their borrowers are bad, those loans all go bad, then they can't make good on the deposits. They go insolvent. And if we didn't have Uncle Sam standing there with FDIC insurance, the depositors would all lose.
As they did in 1932.
Well, that's exactly right. That's what happened in the 30s, and that's why we got deposit insurance, so it wouldn't happen again.
Right.
And then the second thing they got to worry about is liquidity. And that is that if you go to the bank and they create a deposit for you, they expect that you are going to spend that deposit, which means it will end up at another bank,
mm-hmm.
and your bank owes that other bank.
Right.
And what it has to actually deliver is called bank reserves, which is the government's money.
Right.
And so a liquid bank is one that has a lot, has access to the government's money so it can clear accounts with other banks.
Dr. Ray, we have a little less than a minute left. Is it fair to say that in addition to creating money, banks can destroy money, and this is something we have to worry about?
Well, yes, as people repay their loans, the money is destroyed. And if banks don't create more loans, then spending is going to decline and we could find ourselves moving toward recession.
Which is happening right now. They're borrowing money from the Fed really cheap and then investing it with the Treasury Department and making money on it.
Yeah, they're not making too many loans right now. That is true.
Yeah. And so this could be pushing us towards a recession or even worse.
Yeah, but I think, you know, our answer right now, really we need a greater fiscal stimulus because people are already still highly indebted in spite of trying to repay loans.
Right.
The debt ratios are still high in the private sector.
Yeah, the private sector debt is a massive, massive concern. Dr. L. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, senior scholar with the Levy Economic Institute. EconomicMonitor.com is his blog. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sorry, Dr. Ray, that guy always steps on me. Thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Stephanie Miller on the line with us, host of the Stephanie Miller Show and the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour. StephanieMiller.com is the website. Hey, Steph, welcome back.
Tom Hartman, everybody misses you on my show. I had a listener call the other day and say, I love when Tom comes on. You make him giggly.
Oh, well, anytime you want. It's great having you with us. Hey, I have a question. First of all, I want to mention that you and the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour are coming to Fort Lauderdale Saturday, March 1st at the Parker Playhouse. That's a big deal.
Yeah, this Saturday, we were invited for this one for Gay Pride Weekend, and we are thrilled to come because the Sexy Liberal cause will definitely be something marriage equality related because look at everything that's going on in Arizona and elsewhere, right?
Well, that's what I wanted to get to, and the website is parkerplayhouse.com.
Yeah, I think it's almost gone. I think VIP are almost gone, so I would hurry and get those. We have Judy Tenuta and Jackie Schechner
are going to be on
panel with us as well.
So here's my question. Let's say that Jan Brewer signs this law in Arizona.
Yeah.
And I'm running a hardware store, and I've decided that I don't want to serve gay people. And so somebody walks in. What are the questions that I should ask to determine if they're a gay person so I can discriminate against them?
Well, let me just say right now, if you're going to discriminate against lesbians at hardware stores, you're going to lose a lot of business, my friend. And I can say that as a lesbian. So,
okay.
Listen, Home Depot would shut down.
Right.
That's exactly it, Tom. That was the first thing I said. How do you know someone's gay? Are there going to be like trick questions? Are you?
Yeah.
You know?
Do you play for the NFL? Oops.
Right.
Well, at least in a few months. Oops. The NBA, I guess.
Right. But that's what it just goes to show you how illogical and mean-spirited this bill is, and I think that's been the reaction pretty much. And what I was saying this morning, Tom, on the show is that what kills me. Is that, it's rumored, as I'm sure you've heard, that she's probably, will veto it is what's
yeah.
the latest.
She vetoed something similar to this.
Because it's the right thing to do, Tom, because of money, because of the Super Bowl, because of, all the economic leaders and big companies coming to her and saying, you've got to veto this.
Yeah, it's crazy. We're talking with Stephanie Miller, the host of the Stephanie Miller Show, the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour, which is coming to Fort Lauderdale this Saturday, March 1st. At the Parker Playhouse, parkerplayhouse.com, and of course stephaniemiller.com for more information on that. And
sexyliberal.com, sexyliberal on Facebook. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Oh, I didn't have that written down, so I will do that too.
Right.
Sexyliberal.com.
And by the way, I'm thrilled to be on Free Speech TV with you because it's kind of hilarious to be with you and Amy Goodman. As we say, we're the Fruity Pebbles of Free Speech TV. If you need your facts and your intellect, stuff like that, you can go to you. And
there you go.
You know,
we're all having a fine time there. I'm curious how, as a comedian, how do you deal, who also has a personal investment, I suppose, in this, what's going on in Arizona. What do you have to say about it? How do you deal with it? And how can, I'm not a comedian, as you know, I'm the ultimate straight man, I guess. Pun intended. There you go. But how can I and the rest of us help ridicule these fools in Arizona for, this stuff that they're, for stuff like this law? Like you said, the Jan Brewer's not going to veto this because she thinks it's wrong. She's going to veto it because, she's concerned that her state's going to lose some revenue.
Yeah, well, as my fellow sexy liberal John Fugelsang always says, it's a dry hate in Arizona, because I think that, I had Cece Goldwater on this morning, Barry Goldwater's granddaughter, who was, my dad's running mate, of course, in 64, and she just wrote a great piece in the Huffington Post today, Tom, about, thing I always say, this is not Goldwater's party anymore, for sure. He was outspokenly pro-gay rights, and very outspokenly anti-religious right. Remember, he said every good Christian ought to kick Jerry Falwell right in the ass, and these religious right people scare the hell out of me. And he had a lot of things to say about this. He would be, appalled, I think, at what's happening in Arizona as she was. Her brother is gay. Barry Goldwater's grandson was gay. It just is. I think it's so astounding, and I have to hope, Tom, that we have made such blistering progress on gay rights in this country, and I could be very close to marriage equality nationwide. I have to hope this is just like the last gasp, kind of desperate grasping for straws of people that are on the wrong side of history.
I think it is. Look at the fact that in 2004, George W. Bush was proposing a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. Opening up and amending the Constitution of the United States, he was using that as in 11 states, if my recollection is correct, they got it on the ballot in order to get Republicans voters to come to the polls, right? To push George over the top. This was
right. And now, Tom, it's a wedge issue, but against them.
That's right. That's right. And I am hoping that, we can see some ballot initiatives to strike down bans on gay marriage in various states, because I think those will bring Democratic voters out.
People, generally, Tom, I think are sort of recognizing things that are just un-American and unfair.
Yeah, this bigotry is un-American.
That we treat all people equally. And this is just mean-spirited. First of all, they had to show us your papers, which was seen as so mean-spirited. Yeah. Then you have, Jan Brewer sticking her finger in the president's face. It looked like a scene from The Help.
Yeah.
And then you have this. It's just they've become sort of that's what Cece was saying, that they become a laughing stock, and a lot of Arizonans are hopefully sick and tired of it, and they'll vote some of these people out.
Yeah, it's one can hope. And John McCain and Jeff Flake are trying not to be part of that Republicans that get voted out. They're going, oh, wait a minute, please veto the bill, please.
Right. Romney tweeted against it even. It's just interesting that I think that they are a party in such disarray. I don't know if you saw this Republican lobbyist that's trying to get this bill together to ban gays from the NFL.
Right.
He went on record as saying, it's all Republicans. The support I have for the bill is all Republicans that are going to be teabagged.
Right.
That are, have a Tea Party challenge.
And then he lost
It's just for them to, how horrible and political, is that?
Yeah. And then he lost one of his lobbying clients. It's like,
right.
Bang!
Right. And his brother, who's gay, said he's an ass.
Really? Seriously?
Yes.
Incredible. Stephanie Miller, The Stephanie Miller Show, the Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour, sexyliberal.com, stephaniemiller.com, coming to the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale. Hang on just a second, Stephanie. This guy's going to step on me.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That is Saturday, March 1st at the Parker Playhouse, parkerplayhouse.com. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks, honey. Love you.
Great talking with you.
Bye, Tom.
We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 28 minutes before the hour. Minsky on banking. Let me give you the net of what I took away from Randall Ray's piece, his Great Leap Forward article over at economicmonitor.com. And that is that what Hyman Minsky was seeing back in the 1950s was that this very, very stable kind of, you know, post FDR banking system that we had had the potential to go nuts. And it did after 1999 and 2000 as a result of two pieces of legislation by Phil Graham. This is my speaking, not Randall Ray's speaking. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act and Graham Leach Bliley, which blew up Glass-Steagall, changed all the rules. And so the banks went nuts. And when the banks went nuts, they took the economy down with them. Here's the problem. The damage that Phil Graham did to our banking system and thus our entire economic infrastructure with those two pieces of legislation that he pushed through that, you know, to make Ken Lay happy from Enron. His wife, Wendy, was on the board of directors of Enron. Those two pieces of legislation are still on the books. Our banks are still screwed. Our economic infrastructure is still screwed. Professor Chang at Oxford has a brilliant piece that's up. I saw it over at commondreams.org, but I think it was reposted from The Guardian about how we're in another bubble. The crash has not ended. The crash of 2000, which is, I just wrote a book about this. The crash of 2016, that we are still in this crash. And right now we're experiencing the quiet before the storm. Actually, what we're experiencing is the billionaires, the really rich folks, the 1%, the 100,000th, the 1,000th of 1%, pumping this thing back up so that they can suck all of the money back out. And all, of course, the prices are high again. So everybody with a 401k is jumping back into the market thinking, oh, I'll make some money. And boy, are they going to, you know, it's a sucker's market. And because when people stop borrowing money and start saving money, then what you have is the destruction of money by the banks. They start closing out their loans. And as money is destroyed, you go into a recession. So anyhow, my thoughts on that. In Germantown, Tennessee, Mark is watching us on Free Speech TV via Roku Box. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to touch on something you guys talked about yesterday. Sorry about going off topic, but about the GMO thing.
Yeah.
Back on February 19th, C-SPAN aired a discussion that was on food safety that was sponsored by something called the Farm Foundation, which I don't really know what that is. But Charlie Stenholm, he was a former U.S. representative from Texas, and he's a Farm Foundation roundtable member. He said this: I'm aware of people that have had or are having a tremendous amount of influence on food safety questions that are not using sound science. Those that oppose biotechnology, those that oppose genetically modified our plants, they have opinions that they are welcome to. They may be right. But until there is some scientific evidence that they are right, why should we, either by law or by regulatory body, impose costs on our food industry without at least acknowledging that we're going to do some tremendous damage to the hungry of the world?
It's the opposite of the precautionary.
Yesterday.
It's the opposite of the precautionary principle, what he's saying. And it's what the nuclear industry has been saying. You know, it's what GE was saying when they built those reactors at Fukushima, basically.
Yeah. If there's a problem, you'll pay for it.
Yeah,
but
there you go.
We have proof that's safe before we get it out there.
There you go. And now there's a lot of speculation that the cesium plume from Fukushima is going to be hitting the West Coast in the next 30 days. We don't know, but because our government, after Fukushima happened, shut down all the monitoring stations on the West Coast. So now there's this volunteer network that is monitoring the waters out there. And we'll see. We'll see how this shakes out. But it's the same thing with the GMO. It's like, oh, our technology is wonderful, and we can make a lot of money at it. So anybody who says it's bad, you know, it's crazy. Yeah, Mark, I'm with you. Thank you for sharing that. That was brilliant. Bill in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Bill, you want to talk about the Arizona law that Jan Brewer may or may not veto?
Yeah, I do indeed, Tom. I just don't see how she can possibly do anything else but veto it. But Jan is nuts, so who knows for sure.
I'm inclined to agree with you on all counts.
Yes. The
you know, what with the pressure, Apple is talking about putting in a plant here that they are talking about opening in March that's going to employ 2,000 people, and they have already made it known that that's shaky. The Super Bowl thing is a big deal. You know, we got the Martin Luther King holiday because of the Super Bowl long ago. Arizonans just don't learn from their mistakes.
Right.
And I think that the problem here is that, frankly, in the way at least elections work here, the extremes on either side are the most active in midterm elections and are most active in the primaries, even running for state and local offices. And what ends up happening is that they win the day and they get their candidates, the ones who are now in the Arizona legislature, to be the ones carrying the party flag, even though the party itself or the, you know, the rank and file may not want to vote that way or don't support their needs. But when they go to the poll in November, they just vote party line.
Here's the question that I have. The Republican Party, you know, they're 99% of what the Republican Party is all about is, you know, doing whatever rich people want done and big corporations. That's their real agenda. It's like, you know, George Bush in 2004 campaigned on having the entire party submit to Congress a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage. As soon as he won re-election, he stopped talking about it. Over and over and over again, ever since 1973, Republicans have said that they're campaigning on amending the Constitution to ban abortion. And then as soon as they get elected, they forget about it. They don't, you know, they do very little about it, although something is being done in the states. But that's, you know, but that's a somewhat different issue. But the point is that Republicans, in order to bring people in to vote for them, they can't say, vote for me because I'm going to cut taxes on rich people and big transnational corporations and make the air dirtier. So instead they say, vote for me because I got this kind of corporate agenda, but really what I care about is keeping the gay people away from you or keeping the black people away from you or, you know, fill in the blank, right? Whatever you're freaked out about. And as they lose these bigotry levers and they're increasingly losing them, across the country, what are they going to be left with?
Well, and I'm not sure that the Republican Party itself is, well, I am vehemently anti-Republican. I think in this particular case, they have just let the extreme right just run all over them.
But, I mean, people can see this. They just passed a farm bill that granted hundreds of billions of dollars of cash to giant ag corporations, and they will not extend unemployment benefits for 1.7 million Americans, which is just – it's a drop in the bucket. It's just, you know, $6-8 billion. It's nothing. It's like, you know, a day's revenue.
And it's insane.
Yeah.
You know, it's working against their own best interests. One adventure in the way of an opinion here, and this may not sit well with many of us, is that Dems in Arizona may have contributed to this thing. We tend in Arizona to avoid getting into personal relationship kind of campaigning on in the off years. And actually sitting down and listening to folks about what their concerns are, what Wellstone called kitchen table politics.
Right.
We don't do that. We try to, you know, do yard signs and we do commercials and we don't reach out and talk to anybody and listen to what their problems are. Now, what that means is that we don't oppose the extremists in the off-term election. And as a result, they're all sitting down in our state house.
Right.
And I think it's time that at least Dems here or progressives here in Arizona get out and just start talking to people, not to educate them and not to view them as low information voters, but to hear what they are concerned about and express the reality is that they're going to be much better off with a progressive
or a Democrat in office than they are with whack jobs.
The one thing that we know, Bill, from all the polling that has been done over the last several decades, is that when you present a progressive agenda to people, regardless of what they call themselves, as long as you don't label it a progressive agenda, if you say, do you think Social Security should be strengthened? Do you think that Medicare should be expanded? Do you think that unemployment insurance should be lengthened? Do you think that we should be sending our kids to school and paying for their education? Do you think that we should be building our schools and investing in our youth? Right across the board, people say, yes, please do those things. Do you think that we should be putting more cops on the streets as opposed to more people in jail for the drug laws? Yes, please do those things. And I think, in Arizona and everywhere else, we've got a big election coming up in November. It's a BFD, as Joe Biden would say. We need to be going door to door on this thing. Bill, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More of your calls, my thoughts, in the news of the day right after this. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry in Fort Shaw, Montana, watching us on Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Terry, what's up?
Well, Tom, I overheard you talk about the the problem in Ukraine and how it's possible to lead up to a worldwide conflict in that. And I just wanted to say that I had been thinking the same thing here and knowing somewhat of the history in that. And I think a lot of people, to me, I see a lot of similarity between what Putin has been doing to consolidate power and everything in Russia as to the way that Hitler did it in post-war, World War One Germany, and that he came to power. And not to confuse...
Now, Putin's already in power. I mean, Putin's been in power for 10 years or thereabouts. It's not
exactly, but his power started out as some form of a democratic action, and now it has gone ahead and really become rigid and established, and in a sense, my
sort of like the two party system here in America.
It's a police state, pretty much type of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that Russia is a police state any more or less than the United States is a police state. It's certainly not North Korea. It's certainly not anything like Hitler's Germany was. I mean, the pogroms that went on. I think that that's a really bad analogy. The problem that Russia has, in my opinion, is that when the Soviet Union fell, the Chicago school boys went over there. And they said, here's how you put an economy back together. And they pitched the same pitch that they pitched to Pinochet in Chile, which is neoliberalism. Privatize everything. And so all these state-owned industries, all these state-owned businesses, including everything. I mean, the healthcare system, everything was privatized. And everybody got a coupon for a little piece of it. And then some, really slick hustlers started buying up these coupons and ended up owning, buildings and blocks and companies. And you had the rise of the oligarchs. They began playing Monopoly. And so you have a system that in many ways, not unlike the United States now since Reaganomics, where you have, a couple of dozen or more very, very, very wealthy people who have an outsized influence in the economy of the country and now in the government of the country. And we have a very similar problem here in the United States. The difference is that we have devolved down from a more democratic country into this kleptocracy, this oligarchy, and they have risen up from a communist state that didn't work and wasn't really communist. It was more of a kleptocracy to an oligarchic state. And both of us, in my opinion, both the United States and Russia are facing the same problems. And I think the solution in both cases is the same, which is to break up the oligarchies, to break up to neuter the oligarchs by saying the money is not speech, and to enforce both in the United States and in Russia the equivalent of the Sherman Antitrust Act. Although I would not presume to tell Russia how to conduct their own business. I'd leave that to people like Stephen Cohen, who are scholars of Russia. I am not that knowledgeable about Russia's internal politics, but I do not think that Vladimir Putin and Adolf Hitler have pretty much anything in common at all. Terry, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and David in Sacramento, California. Hey, David, Jen Brewer wants her cake and eat it too?
That's what all the Republicans are. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but in a way, this kind of started out with cake. You know, a gay couple went to a wedding cake company, and the wedding cake company said, no, we don't do cakes for gay people, and so they sued. And this law would allow corporations to, you know, right now it's just fine for a church to say, we won't do a gay wedding in our church, and because, you know, this has to do with our religion. Churches are protected for that, just like a Catholic church could say we won't do a Jewish wedding, or vice versa. But what this law would do is extend that protection to corporations, which is nuts.
Right, but I understand what you're saying, Tom, but you got to understand, people in California like me that live here, at least we got it right. You know, the fact we have the UNRRA, UNRUH, UNRRA Civil Rights Act,
right,
where you cannot discriminate anybody in California, which is the penal code under 5.5, under the UNRRA Civil Code is 5.5. When you do business in California, you can't discriminate gay people or straight people, regardless of what. If you want to do business in here, you have to accept all people, equality.
Right.
And then based upon this state, it's no different than any other state at all. The fact is, she wants her cake and eat it too. And she wants to say, well, I want to go ahead and try to kiss their butts, the politicians' butt on their side. You know, I want to give them what they want, the small business, but I don't want to discriminate on the other side. So how am I going to go ahead and meet in the middle? I'm just going to say right now, I voted for Obama. I believe in equality. I'm glad that what people are doing right now are basically cutting corners and say, you know something? Screw the states. Just go to the federal United States Supreme Court and let them decide and forget about all these other people, because what's happening is that they're challenging state by state and they're losing one by one. We're knocking them down one by one.
Yeah, and this is, by the way, David, thank you. You're absolutely right. And this is why I am so glad to see this actually happening this way, because I'm telling you, back in 1973, there were no states that were decriminalizing abortion. I mean, there were federal laws against abortion. There were state, but mostly, I believe, but there were absolutely state laws against abortion. And actually, I don't think there was any federal regulation of abortion. There was a state law against abortion. And in Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court knocked that down. And by doing so, they short-circuited the debate. So there was no national debate. We didn't get to see state after state after state decriminalizing abortion. We didn't get to have a national debate about it. We didn't achieve a national consensus, and therefore abortion is still a highly contentious issue. This being fought state by state is how democracy is supposed to work. It's how American politics is supposed to work, and I'm really glad to see it work. It's playing this way out, because eventually, and I think it's going to be in the next couple of years, we are going to have a national consensus that of total absolute civil rights for LGBT folks, for the entire community. And nobody is going to say, oh, that's because, you know, five justices on the Supreme Court imposed it on us and we're going to start a movement to overturn it. It's going to be because everybody gets it that everybody else said, yeah, that's the way it should be. Tom in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Tom, in the 2016 crash, will our major banks and corporations go under?
I don't know. Tom, I don't know how it's going to play out. My guess is that our banks will be bailed out just like they were bailed out the last time, and that investors, small investors, if you have enough money that it's covered by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, even though they don't have enough money in the bank, as it were, in their funds to cover a large crash, that Congress will simply appropriate it or the Fed will bail them out. So I genuinely do not believe we're going to see a repeat of 1933. I think it's going to be more, a repeat of 2008, which was pretty bad as it was. Tom, thanks for the call. Bob in Brooklyn, you wanted to talk about Ukraine?
Yeah, hi, Tom. So do you know if the Ukraine have nuclear weapons in there?
To the best of my knowledge, they don't. But I could be wrong. No, I'm quite certain they don't. The Soviet Union basically withdrew or decommissioned all of the nuclear weapons that they had in non-Soviet state. When the Soviet Union went away and it was just Russia, Russia basically shut down or decommissioned all the nuclear weapons that they had that were placed outside of Russia. So I could be wrong. There's a small chance I'm wrong, but I'm quite certain that I'm right, that there are no nukes in Ukraine.
You know, I hope so, because if there had any sort of breakup there, the Russians will seize them. But,
yeah.
You know,
I think they did a long time ago.
But the president, by following the policy of the Bush administration, by placing the so-called missile shields in Eastern Europe,
right, in Poland,
has caused a deterioration in the relationship between the United States and Russia.
I absolutely agree.
And for the excuse that he uses, the rogue state of Iran,
yeah.
What I would just love to ask people like him, what kind of suicidal mission the Iranians are on that they would choose to, if even though they developed a nuclear weapon, say they had 10, you think they're going to fire them at anybody?
Right. Well, India has them, Israel has them, Pakistan has them.
Yeah, but you know one thing, Tom, by this move that Obama has made, the Russian general said that he's trying to reignite the Cold War. And 2 weeks ago, Russia has moved tactical nuclear weapons further east towards their border. So
we would too if Canada's government had just been taken down by folks who were in part funded by Russia.
See, that's one of the things that really, really, I'm glad you brought that up.
I mean, just think about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If the democratically elected Prime Minister of Canada had been run out of town, and literally there were snipers who had been shooting police officers, and the week earlier there had been a tape recording released on the internet of Russian diplomats talking about, screw NATO, we're going to decide who's going to be the president or the prime minister of Canada. I think that we would be moving nukes toward our border too. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Whew, what a day. Mercury goes direct this weekend. Yay! And anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does begin with you. Get over to pdamerica.org, movetoamend.org, your favorite activist site. Show up, participate, get out there and and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.